This podcast is part of the Acast Creator Network.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to The Stand with Amy Duncan. Now, things are becoming increasingly serious in the North. The issue is the Northern Ireland Protocol, which is part of the Brexit agreement. And last week, things did not get any better when Sir Geoffrey Donaldson, the new leader of the DUP, said that unless the Northern Ireland Protocol was scrapped, that he would effectively bring down the Northern Assembly and that that would probably cause an election. And it is, of course, very dangerous and very serious for people in the North and, of course, for people down here. This row doesn't seem to be going away and this protocol doesn't seem possible to satisfy both sides. And we're joined now by Sam McBride, who's Northern Ireland editor for the Belfast Telegraph and for the Sunday Independent. He is one of the best journalists around, and his book Burned, which was about the Cash for Ash scandal, is a remarkably good book, and it reveals a lot more about the North than just the Cash for Ash scandal itself. And it's a pleasure to welcome him to The Stand. Sam, Geoffrey Donaldson is a very experienced politician. He's been around for a very long time. He is generally a very sober commentator and analyst. How significant is it that he came forward last week with a proposal to bring down the Assembly effectively unless the DUP's demands were met?
I think, Eamon, that it's hugely significant for one reason in particular, and that is that the DUP, of all of the parties in Northern Ireland, and probably Sinn Féin is very similar in this regard, but I think the DUP perhaps is even more driven by electoral considerations in almost everything that it does. That is at the heart of its success over the last 20 or so years. It has always thought, how do we sell this to voters? What do people really want within unionism? And given that that background, I think that the fact that Sir Geoffrey Donaldson, who, as you say, is somebody who is generally more cautious, more steady, more moderate within the DUP, who ultimately is not even of the DUP. He's a former Ulster Unionist. Yes. He is going in a direction which is something that even 3 or 4 years ago would have been seen by people in the DUP as incredibly reckless, as something that really they didn't stand for as a party. They were a devolutionist party. They believed in Stormont. Stormont was sacrosanct. They wouldn't topple it. It would be bad for the union if they toppled it. And suddenly he's getting into a situation where so soon into his leadership, 2 months now, he is going from 0 to 60 almost immediately. That is significant because that means that that is where the DUP thinks that the most votes are. That's where they think the unionist population are. So this is not some sort of wild solo run by Geoffrey Donaldson. It's not something which I think that he in any way would want to be doing. It's not where he ultimately hopes he ends up, I think. I think he hopes that he gets something on the protocol that he can sell to voters who are angry about it and say that he doesn't need to do this. But the fact that he's threatening this is hugely significant.
Yes, and they're on 13% in the polls, the DUP, so they appear to be in a bit of trouble. in terms of an election, should it happen, are they not party to...
They are.
Are they not party to the Northern Ireland Protocol, and did they not place their trust in Boris Johnson?
So they certainly placed their trust in Boris Johnson. Not only that, they placed Boris Johnson in 10 Downing Street.
Yes.
They were the people who decided he would be the Prime Minister. Arlene Foster gave a slightly cryptic response during the Tory leadership contest in which he came to power. But it was very clear that she was backing him based on the criteria that she set out. It was a monumental miscalculation. It's one for which the party has never apologised, even under this new leader, Sir Geoffrey Donaldson, who had the chance to come in as a new leader, a fresh person, somebody who could say, look, yes, I was very senior at that time, but I'm different. I recognise that we've made huge errors because, frankly, everybody else in Northern Ireland, whether they vote for the DUP or whether they despise the DUP, can see that the DUP have gotten things enormously wrong over recent years. Rather than adopt that humble, contrite tone, yeah, which is not typical for the DUP, he has stuck to the sense that it's everybody else's fault. Somebody else is to blame. It's the EU, it's Dublin, it's the British government. Nothing here lies at the door of the DUP. And that, I think, going into an election is just not going to wash. And as you say, that recent poll for the Belfast Telegraph about 2 weeks ago saying that they were in 13% is utterly sensational. I mean, this is the party that has dominated Northern Ireland politics. It has been the dominant force at Stormont for almost 20 years. And that poll put them in joint fourth position with several other parties, so far off Sinn Féin that they're not even in contention for the First Minister's job in the next election. And so therefore, there is a sense here that this is transparent panic from Geoffrey Donaldson. He needs to do something daring. He needs to be seen to be radically reshaping the narrative. But the problem is that for that to be credible, people have to believe that on 13% or anything like it, if that's remotely accurate as a reflection of where unionist voters are right now, that he is prepared to go in front of the public and face their wrath. I think most people looking at this think that he'd be insane to do that. And so therefore, what is actually going on here? It's desperation. But ultimately, even though I don't think he wants to face voters right now, he might back himself into a position where he has nowhere else to go or he looks completely impotent.
And he's under threat from Jim Allister on the right. Would that be fair to say?
That's right.
The Ulster Unionists on the more moderate side?
Yes, broadly in left-right terms. Alistair is coming from his right flank. Doug Beattie is the new leader of the Ulster Unionist Party. He has significantly revived their fortunes to the extent that in that poll they were narrowly ahead as the largest unionist party. I think it's fair to say that's the first time that that has been the case in any poll for almost two decades since the time of David Trimble. And so therefore, there is a sense of really significant peril here for the DUP. This is not simply about the survival of Sir Geoffrey Donaldson as its leader or the DUP as the biggest party in Stormont. This is about the survival of the DUP as the dominant force in unionist politics, let alone Northern Ireland politics. That poll put them as the third of the three major unionist parties. I mean, It's so far back that there is not even really the basis of an argument from Sir Geoffrey Donaldson in an election campaign that if you're a unionist voter and you don't want a Sinn Féin First Minister, you should vote for him almost through gritted teeth to try to get to try to stop that that eventuality happening. If you're somebody of that very hardline unionist persuasion, you're more likely to, through gritted teeth, vote for Doug Beattie on the basis of that poll, because he's the person that's closest to stopping Sinn Féin, albeit not really in any credible way close enough to actually do that. So it's a horrible position for Sir Geoffrey Donaldson.
Now, Lord David Frost, who's been elevated by Boris Johnson, is taking a similarly hard line. This is a unilateral, really, departure from what was agreed, what he agreed in the negotiations with the EU. The position down here, the fact that Sinn Féin are a long way ahead in the polls, they seem to be certain almost to lead the next Irish government. And there is wild talk down here about a United Ireland poll and all of this stuff. And we feel, those of us who are sceptical about the idea of United Ireland in the next 100 years, there is something going on down here. Bertie Ahern, for example, who was party to the Good Friday Agreement, is saying that we should have a poll in 2028. All of this stuff down here, is it, Sam, inciting the unionists almost and people of a loyalist unionist tradition who regard themselves as British to panic and to be gravely worried?
Yes, it is in many cases. When it comes to people who are voters who are voting for the DUP, I think that that is more likely to be the case than even the typical unionist voter. But I think that it is much wider than that. Even if there was nothing really happening in the South around this, even if the Irish government hadn't really taken any particular role in this, or Sinn Féin wasn't on the rise in the way that they are in the South, what is happening in Northern Ireland is sufficiently alarming for unionists that I think they would be deeply concerned anyway. And as with so many of these things, they come back to Brexit at the point where Brexit was voted for. Northern Ireland, I think, arguably was in the most secure constitutional position that it had been in from the founding of the state. Okay, yes. In the first 50 years of Northern Ireland, it now seems very, very secure because there was very little prospect after the early 1920s of the estate folding into a single entity on the island. But it is something which at the point where Brexit happened had won support not just from Protestants, but from a significant minority of Catholics. And that was something that was inconceivable or would have been inconceivable to the founders of the state in 1921. And yet here was something where, in a very messy way through the Good Friday Agreement, in a way that nobody was entirely happy with, there was grudging acceptance that for now, Northern Ireland, as it functioned, was the best of the options on the table. It was less likely to lead to death, to lead to destruction, yes, to lead to economic peril. And suddenly Brexit tore that up. And that is where the DUP, I think, has shown really scant appreciation of its role in undermining the union. Yes, there are elements of this that were outside its control. Yes, it was a regional party in a parliament of 650 MPs. Yes, it was a small British party in a European Union of many, many parts and many competing interests. But there was a sense here that they did something lightly. They backed Brexit without thinking about where it would end or even, yes, with a coherent plan for what would happen at the border. And there has been no attempt by the DUP to speak to the people in Northern Ireland, particularly Catholic voters, but also some Protestants, some people who would have voted for the union from a very traditional background, who have been so discombobulated by what has happened with this that, yes, they're questioning old certainties. And so if the DUP is the main party in Northern Ireland, can't even understand how those people feel, how can it win them back? I think that is one of the major problems here at the moment for unionism.
And there's no doubt that this protocol does really infringe on the Good Friday Agreement territory. There's no doubt that the place of Northern Ireland in the Union is affected by this protocol because they're subject to different trading arrangements, really. It's a minor change, but they would think, I guess, that it is the slippery slope syndrome, that or the thin end of the wedge, or whatever metaphor you want to use. There's no doubt that it does alter things. And that, I suppose, is another, when you add it to what's happening down here, it's another reason to worry.
I think that, I mean, there were people at the time where the protocol was agreed and where, frankly, very few of us really had much of an understanding about the complexity of global trade. And I think it's clear that a lot of the politicians involved in it didn't have much understanding of it either, where people were saying, this is the best of both worlds. Yes. This is simply about a few rules about how you move goods around. Sure, there's no constitutional implication to that. Don't be silly. This isn't about flags. Don't make it an orange and green issue. I think that as people have seen the Irish sea border develop this year, and it's only really maybe halfway in place now, there's still an awful lot of it that's still to come. So we're not even seeing it in its full glory, if you like. There is clear evidence that this is of profound constitutional significance.
Yes.
The High Court in Belfast has ruled that part of the Act of Union of 1800, which created the UK as it now exists, of course, at that point it was the whole island of Ireland, now it's Northern Ireland as part of the Union, has been in part repealed by this, because at the heart of the Act of Union was not just the idea of a unified parliament in London, and a clear sense of which flag would fly above Ireland and the rest of the UK. It was about trade. It was at its very outset about no tariffs, about equal access to markets. That, of course, has been completely turned on its head by this. But even more significantly than that, and I think something which over time people will begin to realise is enormously significant, is that laws by which people in Northern Ireland are bound are no longer simply set in Stormont or set in London.
Yes.
They are set in a foreign parliament. They're set by the European Commission, by the European Parliament. Those are strictures to which we do not have any democratic say. So there is a profoundly undemocratic aspect to how laws are made in Northern Ireland. So therefore, if you are somebody in Northern Ireland who runs a business or who cares about the environment or has got some other interest in European law which is being developed, how do you influence that? Well, you've got no democratic way of influencing that. Your vote doesn't matter because you don't have a vote.
Yes.
So you can go as a lobbyist. And that is a pretty poor and a pretty shabby way in a democracy, I think, for people to make laws. And so it's one thing for the European Union to say, and as Maroš Šefčovič said to me at the weekend when I asked him about this at a press conference, that there are other people in the European Union who would be very happy to not pay into the European Union and get access to their single market, view this simply as a trading arrangement through the prism of wealth and prosperity. That's a perfectly credible argument. But I think when you look at this in democratic terms, would Germany, would France, would the Republic of Ireland accept a situation whereby laws were being made that were enforced by a foreign court, made by a foreign parliament through which they had no democratic say? And would they accept that simply because it made them wealthier? Some people would accept that, but some people care more about the idea of democracy or sovereignty or national pride. And so I think there has been a very simplistic selling of the protocol to people in Northern Ireland. And as people have started to realise what it really means, there is more questioning around it and more difficult questions, not just for Boris Johnson as the person who basically lied about it, openly lied about it, but for the DUP as the party who initially railed against it. And then come last year, both Sir Geoffrey Donaldson and Arlene Foster either talking up the benefits of it or saying, look, we accept it. It's done now. Let's get on with things. Suddenly, they have been forced by the mass of public opinion within unionism to go in a very different direction.
There's a visceral fear here, isn't there? I mean, we spoke to Billy Hutchinson on this podcast, and I have a good relationship with Billy, spoken to him many times over the years, going back to the really bad years. He said, I'm British, and I'll always be British. And he was speaking for the vast majority of people in the loyalist unionist community.
Well, there are enormous symbolic aspects to this. Even if it wasn't for laws being made which actually bind us, even if it wasn't for the choice of what goes onto our supermarket shelves, where certain items are simply going to be banned from coming from Great Britain. So, for instance, under the protocol, if you want to buy a bare root apple tree or a shrub for your garden that's coming from a Yorkshire nursery, maybe a specialist nursery that sells something that's very difficult to get, it's not only that you have to go through all sorts of bureaucracy and all sorts of extra cost and rigmarole to get it across the Irish Sea, you actually can't do it. It's banned. It's literally banned. You cannot import that. Now, this is something which in a part of the UK where there has been a trade between between all of the British Isles really for thousands of years in plants, in animals, where there whatever the constitutional arrangements, people have moved these things around. That is illegal, but bringing something in from thousands of miles away elsewhere in the European Union is perfectly fine. Now, how do you explain that in terms of plant health, in terms of animal health? How is that logical? But also, even if you don't care about that and you're not a gardener or you're not bringing in animals and it's of no relevance to you practically, symbolism is of enormous significance in Northern Ireland and in Ireland as a whole. And so if you think back a few years to the flag protests in Belfast, where for several months there was serious rioting, there was deep loyalist unease about what had happened. There was a vote to restrict the flying of the Union flag on Belfast City Hall to a limited number of days rather than year round. how did that affect anybody's life in any practical way? It didn't. I think that many of the people who were rioting didn't even realize before that the flag had flown above Belfast City Hall every day. You would need to really be consciously looking for something like that to realize that it's there. But it was something that they felt was moving them a little bit further away from the rest of the UK. And so therefore, in the same way that Brexit made Irish nationalists feel that they were being inched away from the rest of Ireland, that we were being treated differently, that there was going to be something of a differential, whether physically at the border or whether in terms of the rules that applied, the same thing applies equally to what is happening now. So I think that there has been a lack of understanding often by the Irish government, by the European Union, by the European Commission in particular, to the fact that the arguments that they make against a land border largely apply to the sea border. And so if you say that one is unacceptable for emotional reasons, for reasons of disturbing the peace or disturbing the Good Friday Agreement, well, surely the logic of that applies equally. And that is something which has deeply annoyed, I think, a lot of unionists. And when you've got people like David Trimble, who is by no sense a hardliner, this is somebody who really put his career on the line he and did. Ultimately lost his career to back the Good Friday Agreement. And when he is saying this breaches the Good Friday Agreement, but you've got people in Brussels who probably before Brexit had hardly heard of the Good Friday Agreement, certainly I'm sure hadn't read it and don't know very much about the detail of it, when they are saying very confidently, no, Trimble's wrong, we know more than he does effectively. I mean, it doesn't really wash with unionists in Northern Ireland who know who Trimble is. And whatever they think about him, he's got more credibility as an interpreter of the agreement than Mara Šefčovič or somebody else in Brussels.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Now, this is a case of the immovable object meeting whatever. The single market is, as you know, I'm sure, Sam, the pillar, the core value of the European Union. And that is what they see being threatened. And it doesn't look, from where I'm sitting, as if they're going to concede anymore. Where do we go with this now if the Assembly, if Geoffrey Donaldson sticks to what he said, will there be elections? Or will the Assembly just cease to sit and to exist in any meaningful way for the foreseeable or immediate future?
Well, I think that Sir Geoffrey Donaldson thinks and hopes and probably has been given a reason to believe by people in the British government that he won't need to make that decision, that they're going to do something suitably significant, whether that's triggering Article 16 in the protocol, which would allow them to basically set aside parts of what are there, whether it means you basically just on their own without doing that formally, deciding we're not doing some of these checks and what are you going to do about it, Brussels? Whether it is them saying that they're going to somehow push this back so far that it really seems like less of a pressing and immediate issue for unionists in Northern Ireland. I think that he hopes that he can get something there that he can sell to voters and say, look what I did. I threatened this. I upped the ante. And look, I delivered. Trust me. I think the problem for him is that potentially unionist voters are going to be more skeptical than he hopes about that, because the DUP and his position personally have really changed their stance so frequently over the last few years on this. They have flip-flopped back and forth to live with the protocol, to get rid of the protocol completely, now to try to get rid of aspects of the protocol, that unionists are going to be pretty skeptical about that. They're going to look at the small print, and Jim Allister is going to look at the small print. He's a QC. He has got great credibility with the right of unionism in terms of right-wing voters. They will look to him to interpret that, and almost certainly he will say that it's not enough. And so therefore, there is a big question here as to whether Sir Geoffrey Donaldson can sell anything short of a complete removal of the protocol, which I don't think anybody expects is likely to happen at this point. But I think that whereas about, say, 2 weeks ago, I would have been pretty gloomy about the prospects of any serious consensus emerging on this between London and Brussels, I think that over the last fortnight, there is evidence of at least some potential common ground coming here. There is an agreement. If you look at what Lord Frost said in Oxford about 10 days ago, if you look at what Mara Shevchevich said in Belfast last week, there is an agreement between both sides that the protocol must stay. Frost is saying that basically to unionists and saying, I'm going to do a lot here, but I'm not going to get rid of it completely, and you need to know that. There is an agreement that the way that it's currently working is deeply problematic. That's very significant, because at the start of this year, the European Union was basically saying that the fault with the protocol wasn't that it was too onerous, but that the British government wasn't implementing enough of it. So rather than doing too many checks, they wanted us to do more checks. And that was, of course, seen as completely ludicrous by businesses who were annoyed at what was happening, by unionists who were saying that they didn't understand the significance of this. So they have moved significantly on that front. And as a consequence of that, both sides here agree that there have to be changes. There's still a fairly doctrinaire approach from both sides, where the British government say it has to be fundamentally renegotiated. That's what we were hearing from Lord Frost as recently as Monday of this week. But we are, I think, seeing in that something of a semantic debate. Mara Shevchevich says there will be no renegotiation, and he's very firm in that, but he does say that there can be alterations to how it operates.
Yeah.
I think in that there is the germ of an idea that on paper, this protocol might say one thing, but if it's never actually enforced, it's a very different thing. Now, that doesn't satisfy everybody. There will be unionists like Jim Allister who will say that there is a profound constitutional element to this, which simply cannot be dealt with by pragmatic interpretation, if you like, because that then remains on the statute book. That could be interpreted in a different way by a different government or a different commission if there's a changed relationship between Britain and the European Union in future years. But I think that the sting would be taken out of things in the short term if that was to happen. So I think that we are moving towards a position. And I mean, I was thinking about this last week, and if you think about Loch Foyle, there is still 100 years after partition, there is still dispute between the British government and the Irish government as to where the loch to where the border actually lies within the loch.
Yeah.
Both sides claim something which the other side claims. It's never been resolved. And yet it largely simply works. Civil servants find ways to get around this. It's not without problems. There are issues around fishing, etc. And it will be very messy. It will also be problematic if we have a situation where in law there is one situation, but in practice there is another. How does a company, a big company like Marks and Spencers, for instance, with their own lawyers, with their own legal obligations to shareholders, how do they decide how to deal with that? If the law says they have to do something, but they know that a government minister is saying to them quietly, look, don't you worry about that. How do you resolve that? It's going to be very, very messy. I'm not suggesting it's at all straightforward, but I think we are starting to see a situation where the longer that these grace periods get put back, and they have now been put back indefinitely by the British government, the European Union have not really railed against that in the way that they have in the past. The longer that you put off doing something, the harder it is to actually do it. And so, therefore, I think we are starting to see potentially the shape of a future very messy agreement on this issue.
Just a final question, Sam. This is all taking place against what you could, from a unionist perspective, see as an ominous background. You have the European Union. You have Sinn Féin likely to form the next government in the Republic of Ireland. You have the Sinn Féin in the north very, very close to the First Minister's office. And you have a Britain governed by what you might call a delinquent prime minister, and a changing Britain, where the demographics are entirely different, and the notion that we must keep Northern Ireland, it must remain as part of the British, the United Kingdom, and all of that. All of those things are moving in an ominous direction, it would seem to me. And then you have a former Irish Prime Minister Taoiseach Bertie Ahern looking for a border poll just down the road. You have a European Union that doesn't really care about anything other than the single market. And you have a dishonest British Prime Minister. And then you have the changing demographics of Britain. Many of the people have no roots in the United Kingdom and are from elsewhere and don't know very much about Northern Ireland. All of that strikes me as something, if I was a unionist or a loyalist, that is deeply and profoundly troubling.
I think, Eamon, you've set out rather eloquently why unionists feel as they do right now in many cases. There has always been an element of the unionist mindset. I mean, there are people who still talk in semi-joking terms, but it's certainly not fully a laughing matter for them that if you go back to the siege of Derry in 1689, they talk about having a siege mentality because the siege has never lifted for them, and that is something which is at the core, I think, of what a lot of unionists feel now. It's certainly not, I think, as pronounced now, and particularly in younger generations, as it was, for instance, in 1921. I think there have been very significant changes. There have also been very significant changes demographically, because unionism as a whole, Protestantism as a whole in Northern Ireland, is less numerous than it was in 1921. So there are very significant changes on that front, and the census, which has taken place this year, we'll get the results of that probably sometime next year. Will it give us more clarity as to precisely where things lie on that front? But I think that there is a sense that unionists are looking around and they feel acutely isolated. They look to the US president and they don't see much hope there. He is saying openly that he backs the protocol. He's basically taking one side in that. He doesn't even see it in those terms. He thinks that it's not even controversial to say that. But they see that as deeply one-sided. They look to Brussels and they see Brussels, in their view, interpreting the Good Friday Agreement in a nationalist in a way which is interpreted by nationalist politicians and not by unionist politicians like David Trimble. They look to London, and as you say, there's a British Prime Minister who is openly willing to lie to them, who will say whatever is necessary on a particular day with no real thought as to the consequences tomorrow or next week. And they look to Dublin and they see what had been a situation where there was real, maybe not full rapprochement between unionism and Dublin, but there were very warm relations beginning to emerge. Yes. Who can forget Ian Paisley and Bertie Ahern at the Battle of the Boyne site, laughing and chuckling, joking, handing over gifts to each other, etc., etc. Some of that was to do with those personalities, but it was deeper than that, and it outlasted those men. It lasted under Peter Robinson, it lasted under the early period of Arlene Foster's tenure, and that has been torn up. There's a sense now that somebody like Simon Coveney, for instance, is really a hate figure for unionism in a way that no Irish minister has been for several decades, really, I think. And yet there is no real sense as to how things move beyond this at this point. And so therefore, I think unionism is looking at this in some cases, gloomily in a way that is not necessarily as gloomy as they perceive it to be. I don't think that Irish unity is necessarily anywhere near as close as some people in unionism fear it is.
Yeah.
But it's not entirely without logic for them to be concerned about their position.
Theresa May would have been much better for unionism, wouldn't she?
She was much better, I think, in the sense that she was somebody who was clearly a conviction unionist. She really yes. believed in the union. And it's clear from what some of her closest advisors, including Gavin Barwell, her former chief of staff, have said subsequently, that really her central argument around the shape of Brexit that she wanted to see was about the implications for Northern Ireland, for the union.
Yes.
It's difficult to believe that Boris Johnson would think in those terms. He is thinking in terms of what his voters, particularly in England, in the south of England, in particular, are thinking about this. And so it's a much more English nationalistic sense of what is driving him rather than what is good for the union as a whole. But I think that the problem with Theresa May was that while that was her conviction, she simply didn't have the ability to carry it off. She was so completely hapless that from the point where she really came back without a majority in that election in 2017, where the DUP were propping her up, she was so weak that she was not going to be able to get something through. And even what some people now look back on and say would have been a much better deal for unionism, her idea of the backstop, was deeply problematic for the DUP. I think that as a party which argued for Brexit, as a party which said that it would be a land of milk and honey, that it was something that would make things much better, it would make us more unionist in yes. Northern Ireland rather than less British and less unionist. The idea that there could be any sort of border in the Irish Sea was clearly antithetical to that very grand vision. And so therefore, while some people say that would be better than the current alternative, perhaps it would have been, but it still wasn't a good alternative for them. And so I think that her position really from the moment that she didn't win that election was almost completely gone.
Yes.
Yes, the DUP could have decided to back a very soft form of Brexit. That would have been different. They, I think, miscalculated on that front, but that would have had its own problems because if you think about it in these terms, the rest of the UK has voted for Brexit. They want to go and do trade deals. They want to get rid of certain regulations, et cetera, et cetera. All of this stuff about the EU, which whatever the rights and wrongs of this, they didn't like and they wanted rid of. If suddenly they decided that it was such a soft break with the EU that most of that stuff remained, I think there was the danger that not only would that have led to a continued Euroscepticism, which ultimately would have led to a future vote against that, but also it would have potentially led to an anti-Northern Ireland feeling. Because if Northern Ireland was seen as the part of the union that most people in England didn't really care about, they didn't know much about, and it had stopped them getting what they really wanted, well, I think that would have been very dangerous. So all of these options, once Brexit was decided, all of the options from a unionist perspective became progressively worse.
If Geoffrey Donaldson follows through on his threat or promise, will there be an election?
It's very difficult to see. I think that there is scheduled to be an election next May. So in some ways, whether the election comes in 4 or 5 months or whether it comes in 8 or 9 months or whatever is
right.
is not that great a difference. We are headed for an election. We're basically in an electoral cycle now. The campaign has effectively started without any official starting gun going off. And so therefore, I think that this is about bluster. I think that the closer we get to next May, where we're due to have an election, the less, the easier it is for somebody to make a tactical decision to go for an early election. So almost like a tactical nuclear device as opposed to a massive massive bomb which is going to wipe out a whole city. It's easier to do. There are less downsides from the perspective of the party deciding to do that. I think the big problem for Sir Geoffrey Donaldson or anybody else who wants to go for an early election here is that COVID is still a big problem in Northern Ireland.
Yes.
Our vaccination rates were among the best in the world around just after Christmas time. They're now the worst in the UK. I think they're worse now than the Republic. I'm pretty clear. And so therefore, there is deep concern about that. The NHS in Northern Ireland is in deep problems. We're not even into the winter yet. We're only starting into autumn at this point. The hospitals
right.
are already overwhelmed. And so pulling down government in that context is a huge gamble.
Okay, we're very grateful to you, Sam, for joining us. Sam McBride is the Northern Ireland editor for the Belfast Telegraph and also for the Sunday Independent. We're very grateful to him. And his book, Burnt, is about the Cash for Ash scandal. But if you really want to know the way the North works politically and indeed the way Sinn Féin works, it's very well worth reading. Thank you very much, Sam. Thanks to all of you who listened. That's all we have time for now. We'll talk to you soon.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.